Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
It is easy to leave a burning building when it is on fire. But what if that building contains the very thing that gives you life, excitement, peace, joy, courage, and wonder? Will you be an agent of change, or do nothing and eventually leave? If you work in Catholic ministry, business, or education, and need quality content on your website or social media pages, contact The Simple Catholic for copywriting services at thesimplecatholic.blog and click on the writing services page for more information. The Church Militant needs soldiers against the enemy. Enlist The Simple Catholic in this fight for the truth. Good News Ministries of GNM.org. It's the Catholic place for growing your faith. Good News Ministries will provide you with faith-building reflections, virtual retreats, prayer resources, and lots more. All of it is free. Visit GNM.org today.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Socks, a Catholic book blogger. Today with us, we have Michael Naughton. He's the director of the Center for Catholic Studies at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. He holds the Koch Chair in Catholic Studies and is a full professor in the Department of Catholic Studies. He taught in a college of business for over 20 years, and he also serves as board chair for Real Precision Manufacturing, a producer of torque solutions for transportation, consumer electronics, medical, and office automation products with offices in the U.S., Netherlands, and China. He's the author, co-author, and co-editor of 10 books and over 50 articles. He helped coordinate and write the Vocation of the Business Leader issued by the Dicastery for Promoting Integral Human Development, which has been translated in over 15 languages. Today, we have him here to discuss his book, Getting Work Right, Labor and Leisure in a Fragmented World. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks, Pete. It's great to be with you.
So to start things off, great book. What prompted you to write this particular book?
Sure. Actually, I've had a joint appointment in the business school and in Catholic studies for many years. And the relationship between work and faith, work and leisure, the contemplative active life has always been a part of this. And I've been giving a lot of talks, certainly particularly for the last 10 years, but obviously for the last 25 years. And a lot of this came out of talks that I've given, and I will often do seminars and retreats and a lot of discussions, hear a lot of case studies, hear a lot of input and people's challenges. So a lot of it came out of the talks I was giving, and I just thought I had to try to put it down on paper, and I was able to put it in this form, this book form that you have in front of you.
You know, there's a lot to cover in this book, and there's no way we'll get to it all today, but one of the things I wanted to pull out was a quote from the intro, and it says, quote, "We will not get our work right if we don't get our leisure right," end quote. Why are work and leisure so important to each other?
Sure. Well, a lot of us are, certainly a lot of us want to get our work right. We work a lot of hours. A lot of us have, some of us have tough jobs. We want to get better jobs. Some of us have really good jobs, and we really want to understand it. But the point is that when we go back to the book of Genesis, we find out that God made us to work. We're made in the image of God. We're made to subdue and to have dominion over the world. But then God also makes us to rest, and it's that relationship between the work and the rest that for a lot of us we have a hard time getting right. We actually sometimes, and again it depends. But for a lot of us, we get the work right. You know, we often have our own identity caught up in our work, but we've not quite gotten the rest right, the leisure right. And it's not in the balance of the two, but it's in the integration of the two that the deep fullness of our own humanity comes alive.
That's pretty big stuff there. You state that leisure is more than rest time or time off. Many of us think of it as such that, I don't have to go back to work for X amount of days. What is the proper definition of leisure?
Sure. Well, maybe it's important that a lot of us work with a definition of leisure more like we think of it as like amusement. You know, it's kind of escaping from reality. But etymologies are really interesting. The word amuse comes from the Greek word where we get the word muses. And the muses were the goddesses of the liberal arts. They were actually seen as the goddesses of leisure. But that leisure was meant to refresh us, to recreate us, to help us see a much larger world. And when you put the word in front of a word, you know, if I'm a theist, I believe in God. If I'm an atheist, I don't believe in God. The word amusement, interesting enough, one definition I saw which said this, to stare stupidly at something, right? And of course, this is my wife's description of me watching television, right? There's a sense that it's kind of a mindless, you know, it's where the body checks in and the mind checks out, you know? And we often see our leisure as a kind of way of checking out of things. And that's not real leisure. That's actually anti-leisure. That's not where the muses are, it's the anti-muses. And so what we have to try to get away from is that our culture has subdued us into this view of leisure that is really bankrupt. And what's really necessary is for us to see that Joseph Pieper, who wrote a book called Leisure, The Basis of Culture, basically said this. He said, leisure is an attitude of the mind, the condition of the soul to receive the reality of the world. It's really at its heart, it's an act of receptivity. So if work is an act of activity, it's about how I give myself to the world. I give my talents, my energies, my skills. Leisure is an act of receptivity. And that, for many of us Americans, is one of the hardest things for us to do because we're all about being pragmatic. We all want to get it done. We all want to be, you know, we want to accomplish things, which is a good impulse. But our strength here is our real weakness, and we have to learn to foster that habit of mind, the condition of the soul, to receive that reality, to receive God's grace, to receive his word, to receive the sacrament, to receive all those things that help us then to help us understand what it means to give in the world.
Mm-hmm. So one thing you talk about, and I think it's very important, how do we go from looking at our work as a job and instead view it as a calling?
Yeah, you know, the two words I deal with in the book, one is the job, as you just pointed out, and the other one's career. But let me talk about the job. The problem, and this is true for a lot of Catholics, you know, a lot of us don't have great work. You know, I mean, some people have jobs that are pretty demeaning. You know, mm-hmm. They might have bad bosses. It might be designed so poorly. You know, by the way, interesting that Pius XI in 1931 writes an encyclical letter called Quadragesimo Anno. And here's the image he gives is, why is it, he says, that matter goes into factories and come out ennobled, right? I mean, if you've ever been to an automobile factory, it is an extraordinary feat of human ingenuity. Mm-hmm. All this stuff comes in and a brand new car comes out. But then he says, but why is it that human beings go into factories and come out degraded, right? And the whole idea is that, you know, efficiency has become the only predominant value of a lot of work. And the only thing you can get out of the work is a paycheck. And so some people are really beaten down by the work that they're doing. Now, that's one view. But the other view, of course, is that for some of us, we actually go in with really bad attitudes. You know, some of us who are very faithful Catholics, faithful Christians say, yeah, you know, I go to Mass on Sunday and I'm really big in the family, but boy, my job, you know, I just go in, punch the clock, punch out. And Matthew Kelly has a great line where he says, these are Q&S people, right? These are people who quit but stay. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they undervalue work. John Paul II said, work has a subjective dimension. When you go into your work, work is changing. You're not only changing things out in the workplace, but simultaneously that work is changing you. which is why you need to really mindful it. It's why you need to bring it to prayer. It's why you need to, you know, recognize that your vocation can be found in that work. And so I think a lot of us, you know, sometimes we have really bad work, and to be quite frank, sometimes we've inherited bad attitudes about work. So I think that's been the challenge of the job. We undervalue work in often the work that we do.
Mm. So another quote, and that is, we cannot be good leaders if we do not know how to worship. Can you break that statement down for us a bit?
Sure. Well, it's the whole idea at the heart of leisure is worship. And so if we don't get leisure right, we're not going to get work right. If we don't get Sunday right, we're not going to get Monday right. Mm. And if we don't get this activity of worship, we're in terms of where we find our deepest identity. For those of us who find ourselves in leadership positions, and by the way, when I talk about leadership in the book, I don't mean just titles. Leadership is about those who exercise influence in the work that they do. And some people don't have great titles, but they exercise great influence. And it's the idea that your leadership in the way you view that leadership is always going to be connected most deeply to your identity as a person. Mm. And that if you don't get that identity question right, my fundamental identity is not in my gender, it's not in my race, it's not in my ethnicity, it's not in my inclination, right? All those things are important. They're all part of who I am. But my fundamental identity is in that I've been created and redeemed by an act of God, and that my first response to that is praise, which is found in worship.
Mm. And that's a good place to take a break. We'll be right back with Michael Naughton to discuss more about his book, Getting Work Right. You've been listening to Breadbox Media. We'll be right back.
The history of the Catholic Church is often clouded by myth, misinformation, and missing pieces. Today, there is a renewed interest in discovering the true history of the Church, correcting the record in the wake of centuries of half-truths and noble lies. Books in the new Reclaiming Catholic History series, edited by Mike Aquilina and written by leading authors and historians, brings the Church to life, debunking the myths one era at a time. Check out the first two titles in this series, The Early Church and The Church and the Roman Empire, at AveMariaPress.com, or look for it wherever books and ebooks are sold.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. We're here with Michael Naughton, and we're talking about his book, Getting Work Right, Labor and Leisure in a Fragmented World. And last segment, we talked a lot about, you know, leisure and work, and you also write about this problem of a divided life. Can you explain what this is and why it's problematic?
Right. Very interesting that at the Second Vatican Council, in a document called Gaudium et Spes, there's a line in there that the Church Fathers say, one of the greatest errors of our age is the split between our faith and our religion and our professional life. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. In that document, it says, you know, the greatest errors of our age only twice. Once is about the divided life, this compartmentalized life. And the other one is about atheism. So they see this problem that we're living in a culture that we tend to kind of walk into certain areas of our lives with a certain set of standards, and then another area with another set of standards. And this creates that divide. So we talk about, you know, the divide between the public life and the private life, between our faith and our reason, between our bodies and our souls, between, you know, all these things we sometimes separate. Now, they're distinctions, but they're not separations. And that idea of the divided life causes people to live fragmented lives, lives that never quite fully ever come together. And I mentioned to you before in the first segment about Genesis, and there's a guy named, he's a Jewish rabbi by the name of Joseph Soloveitchik, and he talks about that when you go back to Genesis, you see two creation stories. Mm-hmm. The first one is about this one, you know, the act of Adam. He calls him Adam 1. This is the Adam who really works really hard. He wants to create a better world. He's all about mission. He's going out and doing things. But the second creation story is where God blows into the, you know, into grabs the dirt, blows into it, creates human beings. He puts Adam in the garden. He tells him to till it. He puts Adam to sleep. He takes a rib out of Adam, right? He's doing all these things to Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And what Soloveitchik and another guy, another very popular guy named David Brooks points out, is that we've elevated Adam 1, and we've kind of discounted or even demeaned Adam 2. And I think that's part of the divided life, right? We've elevated certain areas. You know, the work life is where our deepest accomplishments are about. What's the first question we ask people, right? What do you do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we want to know what your accomplishments are. But we've now marginalized religion. We've even marginalized, you know, I was just talking to my wife the other day, you know, and she says, you know, I've stayed at home. And sometimes I just don't feel like people appreciate, you know, what happens in the family. And yet we all know the family is the fundamental cell of society. And that's what Adam 2 is about. He's about the covenant. He's about protecting those relationships. Whereas Adam 1, right, he's all about getting things done. And that is sometimes that divide that is causing, I think, serious havoc, both personally, because we never feel like we have a deepened sense of integrity, and also culturally, that we've elevated this type of active life, and, you know, people are not getting married, you know, people are not respecting the importance and the defined nature of what marriage is about, and of course, they're not respecting and recognizing the deep importance of religion in public life.
So dovetailing off that Adam 1 and Adam 2 illustration that you discuss in the book, there's another quote, and that is, Christianity brings genuine hope for deeper integration. The danger for many Christians is a kind of naive optimism about the therapeutic self. How do we avoid that trap?
Right. You know, we who are Christians certainly want to live, an elevated life, a noble life out there. But sometimes we can fall into this trap of a kind of a therapeutic culture that somehow thinking we can do it on our own. It's an age-old problem, you know, of thinking that we can pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps and we achieve integrity. You know, we have integrity. And I think what we need is a good dose, as I say in the book, of Augustinian realism. St. Augustine recognized, you know, he was kind of thrown on his back and said, you know, I've tried to create my own life, and it's really created serious problems. And he's dependent upon God's grace. And again, he's trying to open himself to what God wants of him. And that's why I think the key here is that we have to try to create those conditions to let God speak to us. So we have to stop all the stuff that's going on in our head, right? I always want to become the next president of my university and turn the place around and really do great things with it. And I got all these tapes going on in my head about how I'll do it. I debate with these people at the university I don't agree with. And I have my colleagues, some of them, you know, I just don't agree with them. And I have these debates and I win all the debates in my head, right? And I never stop that tape. And the question is, if I can stop the tape, then God will start telling me some things that I can't tell myself. I can't give myself rest. Only he can give me rest. And he can also deepen. There's a deep well in me that he wants me to enter. And I haven't quite created the condition. So I think that's how you get away from the therapeutic self, is you get away from the therapeutic mind that you're a victim, that you think you could do it all, that you can achieve it all, and you just open yourself to God's grace, and he will tell us things that no one else can tell us.
Yeah. Yeah. Another area of the book I found very interesting was when you spoke to the integration of work and life rather than simply making it a balance. Why does life-work balance give us, shall we say, false hope?
Yeah, I think the balance is, you know, again, there's times for balance, right? I mean, I travel a lot, And I remember having young kids. They're all grown up now, but when they were young, I had to recalibrate things in order to enter back into the household. Actually, I would often be penalized. The longer I was, I could just tell the distance, the greater distance there was with the kids. And so in order for me to enter back into the house and to have the authority that I would have as a father, I had to kind of rebalance the amount of time that was taken away from my children, and I had to kind of refill the bank account, as they would say. So that's a kind of balance factor. But the problem with balance is it's a kind of Adam one solution. I think, okay, well, that's going to solve all the problems, and I put a little bit more over here, and I do a little bit over here, and I kind of work it all out, and I solve it, right? And the balance problem is that I'm still divided, though. Mm-hmm. I got leisure over here. I got work over here. And so it looks like it's a nice balance. And we talk about work-life balance. And again, nothing wrong with it in and of itself. But it's not getting to the deeper issue. The deeper issue is that I have to start to see how these things are connected to each other, how they're informed by each other, how they affect each other to make up one whole person, rather than this kind of, I got a bit over here and I got a bit over there. So that's why I think, again, I think balance is an overused word in our culture. You know, we get a word that we like, and then we try to use it everywhere we go to solve all our problems. And balance simply can't solve divided life. Mm.
So what did Pope John Paul II, we touched upon this a little bit earlier. What did Pope John Paul II have to say about the subjective dimension of work, something that will help us view work as something more than a J-O-B?
Yeah, so John Paul wrote this encyclical letter in 1981. So he became Pope in 1978 on October 16th. And 1981, I think it's his third encyclical letter, and it's on work. Mm-hmm. And he lays out, and it's in the tradition, but he lays it out in his own particular way. And he says, when you and I go to work, we have to change things. Think about the blacksmith, right? He takes the hammer and he's pounding the metal and he's forming the metal, right? And there's a change going on in that metal. But what's really interesting is that simultaneously that pounding is changing the muscle in his arm, right? Mm. There's a kind of connection between the objective thing that you're hitting and the subjective dimension of who's hitting it. Now, we see the muscle grow in our arm, but it's not only muscles that are growing in our arm, but what's happening is that our intellectual, our emotional, our moral, our spiritual character is all providing a certain engraving that's occurring. And what happens is that, in a lot of businesses, you and I were talking about manufacturing where we've been involved. Mm-hmm. They have all sorts of metrics, dashboards that tell us all the things that are being changed out there, all sorts of quality systems, all sorts of things that's measuring productivity, efficiency, right, ratios, everything. But the question is, what's telling us about the change that's happening in us? And that's danger for a lot of us, because 20 years down the road, we wake up and we say, wow, how did I get here? Mm-hmm. Right? Because yeah. I haven't been attentive to the changes that are going on inside of me. And those changes can be pretty debilitating if we're not careful with it. And that's why John Paul, in this encyclical letter, if I would encourage any of you, you can look it up on the web. Mm-hmm. And it's called On Human Work. The yep. Latin is Laborum Exertions. And the last chapter, by the way, I think is the most enduring chapter, because the last chapter is called On a Spirituality of Work, where he lays out the spiritual kind of orientation that we should have in the work that we do, precisely because work is a spiritual activity. It's not just an economic or a physical activity. Mm-hmm. And that's been a long-term teaching of the church.
Right. And when I was in my own struggle with exiting the secular world, that encyclical, I read that a number of times, and it contains one of my favorite quotes. And it says, work was created for man was not created for work. Actually, you used that on a former boss of mine, and he did not appreciate my Catholicism at all.
Well, that's unfortunately the way of the world is not the way of the church or the way of God. So you will get those negative responses as well. Yeah.
So we're going to take one more quick break. We'll be right back to discuss more of getting work right.
Are you married? I'd like to suggest that you often return to the fond and true memory of your spouse when you first met and on your wedding day. Well, he or she is still that same lovable person. Perhaps life has presented many challenges you did not expect back then, but you have come through these together. And the providential fire of your tribulations and your love has forged you into the one body you are today. And that is a beautiful thing. Never let anyone or any inferior thing tear you and your spouse asunder. God is one with you. He is love. Your marriage is love. And love endures whatever comes. It does not come to an end. See 1 Corinthians 13. I'm Jim Littleton of FormingFaithfulFamilies.com.
Welcome back. We've been spending the day with Michael Naughton discussing his book, Getting Work Right, Labor and Leisure in a Fragmented World. And Michael, another great quote here, and that is, we cannot simply achieve our vocation. We need to receive it, and that is why we need Christ, the church, and perhaps, surprisingly, Sunday, the Sabbath, end quote. Can you break that down for us a bit?
Sure. You know, we often think of Sunday as kind of the last day of the week, the mop-up day. We often think about it as a weekend, right, as it's kind of... But from a Christian perspective, Sunday is the first day of the week. Mm-hmm. It's the thing that we ought to lead with. And so the Lord has organized our lives with a kind of rhythm. And the rhythm is that we are to have this day of rest, but the Christian kind of redemptive power of Christ coming into the world has transformed that into what we call the Lord's Day. And so this idea of the Lord's Day is Sunday is one of those critical realities that a lot of us sometimes lose touch with. You know, I often joke that for a lot of particularly Christians, and this is why, by the way, we have to be very mindful of the Jews, because the Jews usually they've held on to the Sabbath in a much better way than sometimes we with the Lord's Day. Mm-hmm. I often say that if I treated, you know, adultery like I treat the Sabbath, right, would not go well in my life. I said, honey, I tried to, you know, live the do not commit adultery commandment, but it didn't quite work out this week. I'll try it next week. Mm-hmm. Right? We know that our marriages would be a wreck, as it would be. But somehow, a lot of us get a look on the casual side of the Sabbath. We don't often see it as having that grave of importance. And yet, I think it's of critical importance. And so that type of orientation, I think, is a kind of paradigm change, particularly for a lot of our Catholics, we Catholics and Christians, who sometimes think of Sunday as 1 hour that we have to get to, mm-hmm. and then the rest of the day is ours. It's the Lord's day, not the Lord's hour. And so that's why the Sunday is just such a critical part of it.
In this chapter that we're covering here, the last one in the book called The Power of Sunday, it's phenomenal. And in here, you talk about the five habits of essential habits of Sunday. And I'd like to cover those and get your thoughts on each. And the first habit is silence.
Yeah, you know, silence is such an important reality in the Christian spiritual tradition. And it's just not the external silence, but it's the internal silence. As I was mentioning a little while ago, right, we all have these tapes going on in our heads, and often those tapes prevent us from hearing what God wants us from us. So the idea of the internal silence is necessary to hear what God wants of us. And so that, I think, is critically important, particularly in a world that's full of noise. You know, I at our university, I often joke that I would bring back smoking on campus. So you can't smoke on our campus, but I'll say I'll bring back smoking on campus if we can get rid of earbuds. Right? You know, and by the way, it's the smokers who are on the edge of the campus going for a cigarette who are all talking to each other, whereas I have all these students walking around with the earbuds not connecting with each other. And they got all this noise going through their heads and all this music going through their heads. And you know, music is great. But the problem with the music is that it overstimulates the emotional sentiment within them, which actually makes it even more difficult for them to reason well. And so this idea that we need silence and an internal silence to hear what God wants of us. And so I think, and it's at that moment of silence of really allowing God to come into us where real rest comes to us. You know, there's that great line that Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and find life burdensome, and I will give you rest." And so all my tapes are a burden, you know, just mm-hmm. let it go. Let go of your image. Let go of your anxiety. Let go of all the things you think you should be doing, all the problems you have, and let him come. But that can't happen if there's not that internal silence. So I think we really got to foster silence. I met Mother Teresa twice in my life, and one time in Calcutta, India. And when I was at the end of our meeting, she gave me her business card, and many of probably viewers know of it. And it goes, "The fruit of silence is prayer," right? And then the fruit of prayer is faith, and the fruit of faith is love, and the fruit of love is service, and the fruit of service is peace. And it all starts in that idea that I gotta stop, I gotta have that silence, and to let the Lord operate within that silence.
You know, the next essential habit you have, three, is celebration. Why is celebration so important, and what do you mean by celebration?
Right. I don't mean cool in the gang that we go celebrate.
Good times, good times.
All right, good times, as they say. Joseph Pieper speaks about this in his book, Leisure, the Basis of Culture, and he says, the celebration is the radical affirmation that the world is good. And what we do every Sunday at the liturgy, you know, that source and summit of our lives, is that it's a radical affirmation that despite all the sin in the world, all the suffering in the world, that God created a world that is good, not because I say it or you say it or we have a majority. It is created by the fact of what it is. And the celebration is that radical affirmation of that. And it's precisely why, you know, weddings, we go to a wedding in that radical affirmation that that love is good. You know, it's wonderful to have the reception afterwards, but it's precisely in the worship where that love is kind of proclaimed in terms of the celebration. And it's also the reason why, you know, Sunday is precisely that day, you know, where we celebrate as a full community. We come together in that Mass to proclaim this kind of radical affirmation that the world is good. And so I think that's when we get at that notion of celebration, all the things that you might find with the cool and the gang and all the parties and all the so-called celebrations we have, those things are not necessarily bad, but they can never replace that act, mm-hmm. that true act of celebration, where there's a radical affirmation of the goodness and that it's created that way and it's also redeemed in that way.
And then you wrap up these three essentials with charity. Why is charity so impactful to us? And there's obvious reasons why it's included on Sunday, but can you give us some insight into that?
Well, it is always interesting, isn't it? You know, Jesus and the Pharisees often get in trouble Jesus gets in trouble with the Pharisees over the healing on the Sabbath, you know? And John Paul II has, he wrote, so he writes we just talked about laborum exertions on the human work. But he also wrote what George Weigel called the bookend of that document. The bookend would be his apostolic letter he wrote called Deus Domine, the Lord's Day. It's a beautiful piece. I mean, again, I would encourage, if there's one chapter to read, read the first chapter. That it's a beautiful description of the importance of the Lord's Day. But in that document, he talks about the importance that when we go to Mass, we have received, you know, this, we've received the sacrament, received the Lord, and in that receptivity, we are called to give of ourselves. And that Sunday is a beautiful day to find ways to, in a sense, provide what Benedict would call. So Benedict describes charity as love that is received and given. And so we have received the love of the Lord. We received the Lord himself through the Eucharist. Now we have to find ways to give it. And we can give it to our family. We can give it to, you know, calling our aged parents or go visiting them or visiting people we know from the church in the nursing home or visiting people who are shut-ins or going down and serving the poor, whatever. You know, you can find it in so many different ways, but we have to find ways to give of ourselves. And Sunday is a great day, depending on your state of life, depending on where you're at, is a great day for that to happen. And it's also, John Paul said, it's the way that people will know that we're Christian. That we give of ourselves. And if we're not doing charity, if we're not doing those acts, then we got to say, how are we living? And maybe we need to make adjustments. Watching 9 hours of football on Sunday is probably not going to be a Christian model of Christian living.
Probably not. So, Michael, if there's one thing you wanted people to walk away from this book after they read it with, what would that be?
Yeah, I think that our identity, our deepest identity, is found in the deepest receptivity that is found in worship, that is found in prayer, it's found in silence. And that's an identity that will get to the core of who we are. Our work is really important, but it's not what is primary. Mm-hmm. Maybe another way of putting it is the primary institutions of our society is the church and the family. And those are the places where we find our deepest identity. Work and politics are going to be secondary. Now, and when I say secondary, I do not mean unimportant. We'll be spending our lives in that particular realm. But don't try to get more out of that realm than that realm can give. Go to the place the deepest reality of who we are in terms of our soul can be found and nurtured and developed, and we become who we've been called to be.
Wow. So where can people find your book, Getting Work Right, Labor and Leisure in a Fragmented World?
Sure. Well, they can just go right on the publisher's website, and that's Emmaus Road Publishing, St. Paul. They can also find it right on Amazon. So they can pretty much get it anywhere on the web. They just put it in, most likely, since people want to sell books. it will pop up right away for them to find it.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Michael Allen, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule and spending with us. Any closing thoughts?
Well, Pete, it's a real pleasure, and I wish you all the best with your good work, and I hope it bears fruit for the kingdom and what needs to be done out there. So thank you.
Thank you. And with that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger, and until next time, God bless.
It's so much more than just a profile picture. At Catholic Singles, our platform offers you many opportunities to get to know the person behind the picture. Sign up today at CatholicSingles.com. Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at KaneFord.com.